Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, better known as the political junkie. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks to be here.
You know, I was just reading your blog posting on the tragedy in Poland, and it made me think about when I was thinking about that when it occurred or after it occurred. How, if the equivalent occurred in the United States, how would we survive? And you ended by saying Poland will carry on. I don't know if we would if something, but it's so incredible what happened.
Well, you know, I mean, there was certainly a strong possibility in on 9/11 when the plane that went down in Shankstown, Pennsylvania, was perhaps headed for the White House or the Capitol.
Yeah.
And the thought of something that calamitous and tragic was just so, you know, incomprehensible. What I also wrote was, you know, it reminded me, of course, of those old-timers who remember, you know, the shots in Dallas in 1963. You think of how horrific that was, and yet there were things in place to make sure that the government was working. The cabinet continued. The vice president became the president. I'm not trying to minimize, of course, what happened, but, I mean, government worked. Whereas here you have so much of the political establishment, the government, the military establishment, all wiped out, and it just leaves you breathless and just, you know, wondering how you can survive, especially in a country that is pretty new to democratic institutions.
And yet you have hopes, or you felt confident in the end that it would.
Well, one would think it was. I mean, I think there was always been a strong, you know, unlike some former Soviet bloc nations, Poland was one of those countries that always had murmurs or you know, below the radar feelings of democracy. We saw that in Gdansk and the strike in 1980, and you feel there are democratic institutions that will survive. And it seems like, then, from most accounts, that, you know, the long time rivalry and bitterness between Russia and Poland seem to be easing from this tragedy. And of course, things could change, but for right now, it seems like Russia is truly, you know, shocked. And of course, the tragedy, of course, with this plane crash coming, which was going to commemorate the slaughter of Polish officers by the Soviets in 1940. And, you know, so there's always been a longstanding enmity animosity between the two countries. And perhaps maybe somehow a little with a tragedy like this, some easing of tensions.
Yeah, I just finished reading a book about World War II, and it's actually called Citizens of London. But a part of that was the Polish underground and how powerful it was for so long. And then to have that happen after, you know, when the Soviets came in was devastating. And then to have this crash, I mean, it all happened. It's just too much.
It's like a curse. By the way, I did not read that book, so don't tell me how it ends. I don't want to know how World War II ended. I want to read the book myself.
Oh, it's so good. I highly recommend it.
You know, actually, I'm reading a fantasy. It's talking about great books. There's a new book out about how FDR tried to pack the Supreme Court. And we can talk about the Supreme Court a little bit later in the show. But, I mean, just the history, it's just so fascinating to learn about, you know, what the court was like back in the 1930s and how the president tried to deal with the fact that the court back then was trying to derail everything he was trying to push forward in the name of the New Deal.
Sounds like a John Grisham novel, but it's
right.
True.
It's really true.
Well, let's talk about the United States Supreme Court. Big changes afoot.
Well, yes. I mean, John Paul Stevens, who a lot of us forget, but when he was nominated in 1975, it was by a Republican president, President Ford, and he was seen as a moderate kind of conservative almost in the fact that, you know, he was just not, certainly not the liberal. He's now at you know, approaching 90 years old. He's the leader of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court. You would have never thought that back in 1975. But anyway, he's leaving, gives President Obama a second Supreme Court opening to fill, of course, last year with Sonia Sotomayor. And once again, you know, a replacement of John Paul Stevens by another so-called liberal would not change the ideological balance of the court, but that doesn't mean the Republicans are not going to do whatever it can to stymie. And I want to put words in the Republicans' mouth. I mean, ultimately, the president could come up with a nominee that will satisfy Republicans, but as we saw with the health care bill, the Republicans seem to feel that, you know, voting no is a successful strategy, at least so far. and perhaps they'll, you know, resume that kind of strategy when it comes to the Supreme Court. But I suspect that with the elections coming up so, you know, less than 7 months away, I suspect that neither side really wants a protracted fight on this.
Well, and to vote no, it sort of depends on who the nominee is.
Yeah, well,
if it's a good nominee, and you can't just vote no just to vote no on something.
Well,
like,
but sometimes they do. I mean, there are some Republicans who, of course, voted no on the jobless, you know, the job unemployment extension insurance, and people will say, well, that's a slam dunk issue. You can't even vote against that. But there's a lot of Republicans who feel that you have to pay for it first, that there are practical considerations there that are being ignored. And there's a philosophy that we're not going to go away just because it may be more popular to vote yes. So, you know, you could say that a good nominee would be welcomed by the Republicans, but you don't know. And it's up to everybody else to decide what an acceptable nominee is. I mean, acceptable to President Obama and the Democrats may not be acceptable to Mitch McConnell and Tom Coburn and conservative Republicans.
No, I was reading a column this morning. it was about Stevens, and made the point that, well, gosh, I mean, we thought we had a good conservative in him, and he has leaned toward the liberal end ever since. How are we ever going to know? And I thought, well, gosh.
Well, the famous quote.
You never will know.
That's true. The famous quote by Dwight Eisenhower is when he picked Earl Warren as Supreme Court Chief Justice, and I guess in 1953. And he later said in his memoirs, Eisenhower said that it was the worst mistake he ever made in his life because, of course, Earl Warren led this so-called liberal activist court with the Brown decision, with civil rights decisions, things like that. And Eisenhower never saw that coming either.
Yeah, the columnist was also complaining that the left-leaning ones never end up leaning right. It's always the right-leaning left. I don't know what that means, but how do you predict? So, but Senate Republican leaders, they've declined to rule out a filibuster, even though you're saying that it could be damaging too close to the midterms.
Well, I don't know what damaging is. I would have thought that there is, you know, with so many millions of Americans without health care coverage, you would think that a blanket no, and that's what the Republicans gave the health care vote, not a single Republican in the House or Senate voted for the measure. You think, well, maybe that's going to come back and bite them in the end, certainly politically. And yet President Obama has not noticeably gained anything, in the polls at least, since the health care measure was passed last month. In fact, his numbers look even weaker today than it did then. And I would have thought that, well, maybe there's momentum. He has this new mojo that he's on a roll. But according to polls, the American people are still suspicious, wary of what these changes entail. And the Democrats don't look any closer to doing well in November than they did a month ago.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, known as the Political Junkie. You know, Ken, regardless of the passage of the health care reform legislation, the economy still stinks.
Well,
and aren't polls a lot more about something like that ultimately?
Absolutely, and I think that's very true. And I think even Democrats acknowledged last month that, yes, we did pass this legislation. It was a top priority of President Obama. But we're still talking about 9.7, 9.8% unemployment in November, it doesn't matter. We could have all the health care bills passed in the world. First of all, one, health care changes probably won't take place, the effects of which won't take place for several years. And two, the fact is that most people out of work will still feel, you could blame George W. Bush all you want, and of course a lot of the blame deserves to be placed on George W. Bush, but the fact is, I think a new president has about a year to keep blaming his predecessor, and ultimately it becomes his economy, just like Afghanistan is his war, meaning President Obama, and he's going to have to take control of it.
So how much might comprehensive and strong changes in the way the financial system is regulated play out at election time, if they succeed with that?
Well, they're talking about, there's so many things on the table. Of course, you know, Harry Reid also said that he wants a new immigration bill passed. And again, when you have 9.7, 10% unemployment, the last thing a lot of politicians are going to vote for is to allow more or to sanction more illegal immigrants to stay in the country and compete for jobs that so many people are no longer. They no longer exist because there are fewer and fewer jobs. Not that and everybody else will take these jobs anyway. But the point is that so many things are happening with the specter of the elections right around the corner. I don't know what the financial markets and the changing of the financial institutions means politically, but again, there's a calendar. The calendar says November 2nd, and it's coming up plus. And so when you have the financial institutions plus the unemployment, plus the immigration bill, plus now a battle over a Supreme Court nomination, all, you know, to be done before they leave for the congressional and pre-election recess, has a lot on a plate. And we just, and you wonder how much lawmakers are still willing to go through another battle after what happened over health care.
Now, the Obama administration says that they're not going to shut doors on any potential nominees, but people, of course, look to the ones from the previous appointment, the Sotomayor appointment, you know, other potential nominees at that point. What's jumping out at you is likely?
Well, I think that's the exact reason why we expect a new nominee to be named pretty soon, because of all the vetting that went on during the Sotomayor hearings. But of course, Elena Kagan, the Solicitor General, mm-hmm. is high on the list. Diane Wood, the federal appeals judge from Chicago, who actually I thought was going to get the nomination last time, she's there, as well as Merrick Garland, who's a appeals court judge in Washington. And there's also other names mentioned: Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, the former governor of Arizona, she's mm-hmm. on the list, as well as Jennifer Granholm, the outgoing governor of Michigan. I mean, I've seen actually what I thought would be a great choice would be Judge Reinhold, because then, you know, you just picture him as a judge, and I just realized he's an actor. He's not really a judge, so I don't know if that would really work. But I mean, the list is
There's so many actors that have been politicians. I thought, wait a minute, did he run for something?
That's exactly right. I mean, next thing you'll tell me is Al Franken is the United States Senator. But look, President Obama says he's not going to rule anything out.
Except for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, something, I saw that, and the blogosphere was going crazy. And it would be an ultimate a capstone to an incredible career. But White House press secretary said yesterday, not the official press secretary, but a press person, said that the president is very happy with her job as Secretary of State. And he sees no reason why that should change. Of course, things can change on a dime, but I suspect that she is not on the short list.
Okay, my guest is Ken Rudin, political junkie, NPR's political editor. If you have a question or comment for Kent, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email to sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Support WOSU by bidding on unique culinary-themed packages online. With the Chefs in the City Baker's Dozen, you can bid on 13 of the most sought-after Chefs in the City silent auction packages, even if you don't have a ticket to the event. Just go to WOSU.org/chefs to view all 13 items up for bid and make your bid now. That's WOSU.org/chefs. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Sunshine today. A slight chance of afternoon rain and a high of 68. A few clouds tonight, a low of 42. Sunshine on Wednesday and a high of 73. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. Ken, Patrick Leahy, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, has predicted that the nominee will be confirmed before the new session begins in the fall, in October. What would be the timeline to accomplish that with the summer break ahead and that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, obviously, as we said before, that we think that many of the Elena Kagans and the Diane Woods of the world have already been vetted, so we don't think that there's going to be a protracted decision-making process by the White House. And then once you – and since people like Diane Wood and Judge Garland are well-known folks in the legal and political community, I suspect that the hearings will be – you know, will go on very quickly. I mean, the Congress doesn't go out until August. Again, Harry Reid still talks about immigration reform and stuff like the financial regulation. I suspect, though, that if they get this on the in the Judiciary Committee early, that that'll probably preempt everything else. But it's doable. It's certainly doable. And I mean, Sotomayor, for all the controversy over her so-called the empathy stuff that in retrospect seems so ludicrous. But, of course, it was the thing that took over much of the debate last year during her nomination. I suspect that it's very, very doable.
Moving on to the – I was on vacation last week, so I want to talk about stuff that I missed.
Vacation? What's that?
You've forgotten already?
What's that?
Yeah. How soon we forget. I don't know. My lips are chapped from the sun. That's the only thing that's reminding me right now. Should Republicans be the party of no? That was the topic in New Orleans a few days ago.
Well, that's should they be the debate party of that's going on with the party. Obviously, if you ask Sarah Palin, she'll say it's not. We're not the party of no. We're the party of hell no. Mm-hmm. And she gets a huge ovation every time she says that. And the feeling in New Orleans, where the Southern Republican Leadership Conference held its conference last week, the feeling was we're doing the right thing. The polls show we're doing the right thing. Obama's numbers aren't improving. And for all the talk and focus on 2012, the real issue is 2010. Governor Rick Perry of Texas probably correctly said that the 2010 midterm elections will be one of the most important midterm elections in recent memory, and that may very well be true. Mm-hmm. Of course, every election is the most important election in the world until the next election, and that's what we keep doing. But obviously, Republicans have tremendous hope for November. They think they have the public on their side. Even though, you know, you talk about the weak numbers for Obama and the weak numbers for the Democrats in Congress, the numbers for the Republicans in Congress are not much better. There are new polls that show that more people do support Republicans than they do Democrats, and that's the first time we've seen that in 4 years. But again, ultimately, the decision is not going to be whether the Republicans, the Democrats say yes and the Republicans say no. It's what the two parties are offering. And Republicans do know that they're going to have to offer something other than no if the voters are going to consider them in November. But stranger things have happened. You know, in 1994, when the Newt Gingrich took over, when the Republicans took over control of Congress, a lot of it was just antipathy for President Clinton and the Democrats. You know, and in previous years also, when the Democrats came back after in 1974 during Watergate, a lot of the Democrats, all they had to offer was a D next to their name as opposed to an R, and that was good enough. So perhaps that may be all the Republicans need in November.
Yeah, of course, Newt Gingrich in New Orleans last week was one of those that said, no, we shouldn't be the party of no.
Gingrich has always been kind of the type who's always been on the outs with some of the more conservative. You know, you think of Newt Gingrich, people who don't know him think of him as one of these right-wing ideologues, and he's never been like that. When he was Speaker, he was always looking over behind his shoulders for either perceived coups or likely coups from Dick Armey and Tom DeLay and things like that. So Newt always had his problems with the more conservative elements in the Republican Party. And while he is a conservative, he's always said that, so look, just saying no and not offering big ideas, and of course Newt has always been a guy of big ideas, say that that's not the way to go. So that's a philosophy that is not shared by, I would say, a lot of people in the Republican Party.
Yeah, Senator Scott Brown, the Massachusetts Republican, was elected to replace the seat vacated when Senator Kennedy died. He turned down an invitation to attend a rally in Boston this week with Sarah Palin as speaker. It was a Tea Party group. And, you know, folks are kind of wondering, wait a minute, was he playing us?
Well, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people are reading into Scott Brown what they love to read. A lot of people said that his election is valid, you know, valid, proof that the Tea Party is alive and well in states like Massachusetts. But his rhetoric, if you think of his rhetoric during that whole campaign, it was pretty moderate. And Scott Brown has turned out to be pretty much of a moderate Republican voting for the jobs extension, you know, unemployment extension stuff. He was one of the few Republicans who broke the filibuster yesterday on that bill. Mm-hmm. So there are some in the Tea Party who are calling him a Judas and a traitor. And that's the problem with some of these people, that they feel that when things are going their way, you know, the rhetoric is pretty tame. But if there's a perceived slight or a perceived betrayal, the language can get very, very ugly. And I'm not saying that – I'm certainly not saying that a majority of the Tea Party people are behind some of the ugly rhetoric. But we did see a very unfortunate bit of spitting and name-calling and epithets thrown at members of Congress after the health care vote. And you know, that you know, if the moderate center or the center of this country is going to look at Tea Party people, tactics like this, even if it's by a slight majority, is not going to help their cause.
You know, I was sort of shocked to read on Monday that Tea Party leaders in Oklahoma City and some conservative members of the legislature in Oklahoma are talking about creating a new volunteer militia to defend against what they believe are inappropriate or improper federal actions on state sovereignty.
Yeah, there's a lot of scary stuff out there. I mean, I remember the stuff with the John Birch Society in the mm-hmm. 1960s, and you know how the UN was a, you know, an instrument of the communist conspiracy and things like that. And so we've seen either paranoia or just, you know, conservative fears about big government for years. Some of it is legitimate, some of it is over the top, but some of the language I've seen, and you're mentioning some of the things that are probably less. I mean, I've even heard worse things from members of Congress, not members of Congress, but members of state legislatures mm-hmm. around the country that are bordering a pretty scary stuff. And I think, you know, there's just a lot of fear and uncertainty out there, and the question is whether. How the Republican Party rides this? Do they ride it to their benefit? Do they help them in November? Or does this kind of rhetoric scare the middle America away from voting Republican? So it's a decision that a lot of the party is watching very carefully.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Rudin, political junkie, NPR's political editor. Ken, we have a email right now. If anyone would like to email us, go to allsides@wosu.org, or you can call us at 614-292-8513 to speak with Ken Rudin. This is an email from a listener. They write, away from cameras and microphones, do you ever encounter Republicans who express true embarrassment with regard to Sarah Palin?
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sarah Palin, I mean, look, she will get people on their feet, and whatever you think about John McCain's decision to name her to the ticket in 2008, John McCain did not get Republicans on their feet. Sarah Palin does do that. But at the same time, there seems to be a lack of either curiosity or just a satisfaction in let her say what she wants. We don't know if she wants to be Rush Limbaugh or Oprah Winfrey or the 2012 Republican nominee. And so there are a lot of Republicans like who are seemingly more thoughtful, like Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, or Mitt Romney, and yet when they give their speech, you know, it's blasted by members of the party saying it's just milquetoast, it's just not the red meat that they need. So, yes, there are a lot of people who roll their eyes at what Sarah Palin has to say, but there's no question that she's a rock star. She went, you know, last week to Minnesota to campaign with Michelle Bachmann. She was in Arizona a week or two before that on behalf of John McCain. She was in Nevada campaigning against Harry Reid. Mm-hmm. But she gets the headlines. The newspaper people, the TV people are there to capture everything she says, and for better or for worse. And the question is whether, you know, this is such a thing as bad publicity. And so far, that's what they have to wrestle with.
Yeah, and you raise an interesting point saying the new Oprah, she is going to have her own television show. So that's different. It makes you wonder really what direction is she headed.
She is she's a phenomenon. I mean, let's face it. She served, you know, she left her full-time job of governor of Alaska. She left it before it was over. So we don't know. I think she's also carried away with her newfound celebrity, but it's real. It's out there. There are people who just adore her, and You know, you think of all the other possible people who may run for president in 2012. Nobody, and bar none, there is nobody on the Republican side who excites a crowd like Sarah Palin.
Have you spoken with her personally for any length of time?
No, never have. I've never gotten a matter of fact, and I've tried to reach her several times. It's almost impossible to reach her unless you're part of Fox News, because she talks to Fox News, and she talks on her Facebook page, and she talks on her Twitter page, but she doesn't talk to, you know, the rest of the media, and I guess she feels there's no reason to, because we, you know, I guess the feeling is on that side is that we would distort anything she would say. We saw what happened with her, you know, the Katie Couric and the Charlie Gibson's interviews, and so she's probably satisfied with just, you know, doing the little Fox show, giving the speeches, and you know, offering her pronouncements on Facebook. But right now, we've tried, NPR has tried, and we have not come close to getting a yes from them.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Bob, you're on the air. You want to talk a little bit more about the Tea Party?
Yes, I do. Back when I taught ethics for public policy people, I used to ask them a question. And the question was, how do you know that you're not making shower heads for Nazis? And I'm not saying, but I think it's the current situation of division in the country and name-calling may put pressure on that question again. And I wonder what Ken Rudin think, whether he might have any thoughts about it.
The point being that how do you know that you're not working for somebody or fighting for something that isn't what it seems?
Well, that's pretty much it. Like, not all Nazis today wear jackboots. Okay. But I don't know I'm not sure that everything, well, it may be true that everything is relative, but it may be true that some things are different than just relative. That they're, like, Nazis aren't just relative, for example.
Ken?
Well, I'm very, very hesitant of throwing out the term Nazi for anybody who's other than the Nazis. You know, I mean, George Bush was called a Nazi. There's a lot of when I see these protest rallies against Obama, you see him drawn as Hitler. To me, that's a comparison that's well over the top. Having said that, and I wouldn't, the thought of comparing anybody to a Nazi is just incomprehensible to me, because there are some things that just do not deserve a comparison to something as horrific as that. But having said that, there are some indications and signs of intolerance in this country that scare many people, that you'll be spat on, you'll be, you know, homophobic things, racial slurs, and you just wonder if the amount of intolerance and the amount of ignorance in the country is getting to the point where just, you know, a know-nothing party could make a difference. You know, we see this in countries of Europe where even though they'll only get 4, 5, 6% of the vote, that's still alarming. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the David Dukes in this country, who was a former Klan leader who ran for the Senate and governor of Louisiana and got over 40% of the vote. So there is, you know, and there are a lot of people who compare David Duke to Nazis, you know, but the Tea Party is more than just the people who are screaming epithets. It's people who are or fearful of losing their job or have lost their job, who would feel that government has lost their way, or that we're taking on projects that we can't afford, or we just don't know what we're doing. So the term Nazi is not the term I would use, but I think there is a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of ignorance out there. There's a lot of fear out there. And when you combine misinformation and fear, you can have the prospects of an ugly ugly movement. But Nazi is not the word I would use.
You know, Nazis, obviously the loaded term. You know, when people are drawing mustaches and that sort of thing on somebody to recall Hitler, it's why don't they just go ahead and put the horns in it? It's to me, Nazis like the comparable to the devil, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, but
how ridiculous is that?
Yeah, but I mean George W. Bush, whatever you think of him, mm-hmm. compare George W. Bush or Barack Obama or anybody in American political life to Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin or something like that is, I think, one step beyond where we're, or several steps beyond where I'm willing to go.
Okay, thanks for the call, Bob. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll return. If you would like to speak with Ken Rudin, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's a lot more to talk about when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
In 1937, frustrated by a conservative Supreme Court which struck down a series of his New Deal programs, President Franklin Roosevelt tried to reform the court by expanding it and adding liberal justices. This controversial proposal failed. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeff Schessel, author of Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Tonight at 10 on WOSU TV, Frontline goes behind closed doors at the White House, in Congress, and the boardrooms of the giant healthcare lobby to examine the political battles and costly compromises that defined Barack Obama's endeavor. It's a sobering expose of the realities of American politics, the power of special interest groups, and the role of money in policymaking. Watch Obama's Deal on Frontline tonight at 10 on WOSU TV. 54 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine later this afternoon and a high of 68. A few clouds tonight, a low of 42. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 53. And more sunshine for Thursday with a high near 80 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin. Ken, a little upheaval in the labor world. Andy Stern is leaving the Service Employees International Union, possibly, well, the most influential labor. Well, you said you call him the most influential labor official in the country.
Oh, I think he is by far. I mean, I think he has taken as a kid, you always think of the George Meanies of the world or the John Sweeneys or things like this. But Andy Stern has been a real political activist. He was, arm twisting members of Congress regarding the health care during the health care legislation debate. He threatened a lot of Democrats with retribution if they voted against it, especially the Democrats who received union backing in the past to win election. And, the thought of him with a Democratic president and with the health care legislation passed that he's leaving, people just wonder why now. I mean, mm-hmm. you could say, well, he's accomplished everything he wanted to accomplish, but that's not true. There's a lot of legislation like the Employee Free Choice Act, the card check bill that labor mm-hmm. has not passed yet. There's still fears of a Democratic rout in November, right, that could decimate their ranks. So a lot still has to be done. And he's only 59 years old, but there is a lot of rivalries out there. When he pulled the SEIU out of the AFL-CIO, a lot of people thought that would be a great idea. But in some ways, it split the labor movement, people thinking maybe that's not the way he should have gone. But so even though there's a Democratic president, a Democratic control of Congress, health care is passed. They got Craig Becker, the SEIU lawyer, on the National Labor Relations Board as a recess appointment. Some things have gone labor's way, but a lot hasn't. And there's a potential of a lot of things going wrong, bad for the Democrats in November. There are a lot of people wondering why he would leave now when so much needs to be done.
So splitting off from the AFL-CIO like it did it dilute the power of the unions more than they really could afford right now? And there's talk that they may go back together again.
Well, there was talk. I mean, at the time, there was some feeling among the more progressive and the more politically active folks in the labor movement that the AFL-CIO was pretty staid. It wasn't, you know, doing what it could have done. And Andy Stern was a dynamo with a very growing and a very potent labor organization there. But in recent days, recent months, there's the consideration that perhaps they did not accomplish as much as they could have accomplished, and maybe the way to do it is to unite and perhaps rejoin the AFL-CIO. Richard Trumka, who's the president there, is also politically active and politically strong, and perhaps under Trumka's leadership, that you know there could be a renewal of labor strength. But you know, if you look at families around the country, fewer and fewer families are labor members, labor union members, and the labor vote that was so significant in presidential elections in the past, I think are certainly less so now. You could say that, yes, they were influential in helping Barack Obama win in 2008, but basically anything, you know, anything would have elected Barack Obama in 2008, given the war, given President Bush's unpopularity, given the state of the economy, the loss of jobs, the rise in prices. So with a strong labor movement or not, Obama was going to win. The question is whether what kind of strength labor has for the midterm elections and beyond.
Right, and exactly. So, you know, ergo the timing question on this, maybe right after the elections perhaps, but 6 months out?
Yeah, a lot of people were surprised. And actually, the funniest thing of all is that I was in the middle of the post when of course, this interview was planned, but I was on the phone with some SEIU people on background, and I was about to get some good stuff, but I ran out of time. So as soon as this program is over, I'm going to go back to reporting on that.
So it's all my fault, is what you're trying to say.
You have to blame. You know, everyone likes to blame everything in Washington. I'll blame it on Anthony.
Yeah, so easy. 614-292-8513. If you want to speak with Ken Rudin, let's see. Delbert, you want to get back with that who's more disrespectful to who question?
Hello?
Hi, Delbert.
Hi, how are you? Yes, I think that the Republicans have been acting very mean-spirited. Because even after George Bush, when we felt like that he did not win neither his first election or the second term, we still were very respectful of Mr. Bush. And when President Obama took office and there were some boos when George Bush came down, and the president asked the people to not act that way. So he was very, you know, and he won by a great margin. And they're just so mean-spirited. They just won't let him govern. And most of their people, I just don't understand that they don't see the lies that the Republicans tell that got the country so mixed up, because they have misspoken about the health care and what it's going to do.
Okay.
And I think it's a benefit for the majority of the people, but the Republicans have their rhetoric has been so false leading that they've got the people. I just don't understand that how they believe in what the Republicans are doing.
Let's ask Ken.
Well, Delbert makes a very good point in that the tone and the civility is awful, and civility is gone. And I don't know whose fault it is, or I mean, everyone can say, well, you started. Was it the Bork nomination? You know, the Robert Bork nomination in 1987. Was it, you know, the Teapot Dome scandal in 1920? I don't mean to blame everything on Warren Harding, who's of course from Ohio. But the thing is, it was very, very ugly under Bill Clinton. It got uglier under George W. Bush, and it got even far uglier under Barack Obama. The rhetoric just keeps accentuating the line that you never think people are going to cross. They cross, and of course, it's egged on by the folks. You know, if you're a conservative, it's egged on by the folks at Fox News. If you're a liberal, it's egged on by the folks at MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, people say, well, Bill O'Reilly is far worse than Keith Olbermann. But that's not the answer. The answer is both sides just use horrendous rhetoric. I've seen countless times when Bush was either named as a Nazi, signs portrayed him as a Nazi, or things like that. And sure, and I'm just saying, well, since the Democrats did it to Bush, it's okay for the Republicans to do it to Obama, because I think it's worse now, but it keeps getting worse, and nobody says enough is enough. President Obama, and Delbert's right in this point too, President Obama from the beginning is saying, look, let's tone this down. This is not helpful. It's not helpful for any side, but nobody listens because there are no consequences.
You know, the last time we talked, it sort of ended on a – it's kind of – You seem pretty down about all that.
Well, I do. I am down about it because, you know, like, again, like, somebody was, a friend of mine, not a friend of mine, but somebody I know was talking about running for Congress, and he was very idealistic. He happens to be a Democrat, but not that that matters. And I said, not to give anybody advice, because I would never give anybody professional advice on something like this, but I wonder why anybody would want to come to Washington. Who's going to make a difference anymore? The one party votes one way, the other party votes another way. There was obstruction by the Democrats mm-hmm. with President Bush, which has gotten worse under President Obama. But both sides do it, and both sides continue to do it. So for everybody to say, "How dare the Republicans consider filibuster against President Obama's Supreme Court nomination?" Well, Democrats, including Barack Obama, voted to filibuster, you know, Samuel Alito, which is President Bush's nomination. Now, Democrats could say, well, Bush put these right-wingers on the court, and this is not what Obama's doing, and there may be some truth to that. But both sides play the game, and both sides complain that the other sides play the game. We saw that with filibusters. We saw that with reconciliation. We saw that with, deem and pass, that the one side will say, well, I can't believe you're doing that. And the other side will say, well, your side started it first, and it doesn't change. And I don't know what the answer is.
The term limits don't apply at the federal level, but a lot of folks at the state level are promoted up to the federal level, you know, through the legislature. We have term limits in Ohio. It's pretty – a lot of folks believe and for good reason, probably, that there's a lot of polarization because of term limits.
Well, I've always been – I don't have positions. I don't have any positions on things, except I do have a feeling about term limits, and I've always been against it. It's undemocratic. If you want to reelect your congressman, your state legislator, your governor, do it. You should have the right to do it. You shouldn't have a fake term limit. First of all, once you're reelected to a second term, you're already a lame duck. So your effectiveness is definitely limited. And two, you know, it just takes away the choice from the voters. If you hate your lawmaker, as everybody says they do, or they hate it, vote him out. Vote him or her out. Now, it's easier said than done. Of course, incumbents have more money, more access to money than challengers do, and I understand that. But at the same time, to take the decision out of the hands of the voters and have these artificial thing called term limits, I just think it's a big mistake.
And the way we draw up our districts are another factor.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are very few states. There's some states like Arizona, Iowa. There may be one or two others that do it by independent commissions. But basically, whoever controls the state legislature draws the line. So you'll have somebody who was elected by voters, and suddenly that person will find himself not even living in the district anymore because they'll draw the lines to exclude his house, which is what they really do. I mean, I've seen some of these lines where they zigzag just to get somebody's house out of the district. Now, of course, you could still run for the office even if, like in Congress, as long as you live in the state, you can run wherever you want.
Right.
But, I mean, it's a game that they play, and it's playing with – I guess this is what democracy is all about, but sometimes it just doesn't work so well, and it's certainly not working well now.
So where are those in this upcoming primary season, are we in the midst of it, coming up where there are seats in play?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, there's nothing going on. There's a special congressional election today in Florida that people are not paying attention to. But next month, there are some major, major primaries. For example, May 18th in Kentucky for the race that Jim Bunning, the senator Jim Bunning, is giving up. Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul, is running against the Republican establishment. I got Secretary of State there by the name of Trey Grayson, a big primary there. On the same day in Arkansas on the Democratic side, Blanche Lincoln, the Democratic two-term senator who has given many Democrats fits because sometimes she's for health care, sometimes she's not for health care. Sometimes she's very nervous about getting reelected, and in doing so, she really drives progressive nuts. Well, the lieutenant governor of Arkansas, who's also a Democrat, Bill Halter, is challenging her in the primary, and he has a very good chance of beating her because a lot of just Democrats are just angry with her. So both sides, both parties are going through these upheavals. We see it in the sense The list was sent in Ohio on May 4th with the Senate race,
right,
for Voinovich's seat. You know, you have Lee Fisher, you have Jennifer Bruner, and it seems like everything I read lately, everybody and his sister and brother are endorsing Lee Fisher, and yet the polls are very, very close.
Right.
I know Bill Clinton came out for Fisher a few weeks ago, and yet and she has no money at all, and yet apparently the two of them are within points of each other. I don't think that's not showing that's not the kind of ideological schism I'm seeing in places like Kentucky and Arkansas. But there are a lot of states where even the parties can't get their act together, and it'll be it's been an amazing year to watch.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Dave, you're on the air. You want to talk about how Ken does his job?
Okay, well, actually more your opinion, and I'm just going to give you a scenario, and I wish your opinion. I believe death panels, I believe birthers, I believe take your guns, I believe any mud you can throw at the situation works these days, for facts are unchecked, frequency is everything, anger wins, and until a major election comes through that civility trumps anger, we're going to continue to see this, and I would like to get your opinion.
Well, your opinion is my opinion. I agree with you completely. That's exactly what happens. If you keep saying it over and over and over again, like with the death panels, I mean, Sarah Palin has been told over and over again that the death panels are not part of this bill, and yet she says it, and she gets the same reaction every time. And I think both sides do it, but it's clear there's no civility, there's no, especially with redistricting, and we've talked about this many times in the past. If I'm safe in my district, I'm a conservative Republican, and I'm safe in my district, and you're a liberal Democrat, and you're safe in your district, there's no reason for us to talk across party lines mm-hmm. with each other, because we're both safe, so we don't have to compromise, we don't have to come to a common solution, and so we just yell at each other, and that's exactly what happens. And I don't know how it changes. I don't think it's – I mean, everybody likes to say it's never been this bad, but I really think it's true. It hasn't been this bad.
I believe it's worse only because the proliferation of unchecked media makes it worse, because if you can go on daily on a major network, question something with nothing to back it up, eventually it takes root. I'm wondering.
Well, that and the internet, too.
The internet is a billion different ideas. Mm-hmm. The one comfort there used to be in the three big networks was, well, they would all agree to at least an established basis of facts. Where would this come from in the future?
Well, the only thing I've noticed is that I read this in the paper today that on ABC's This Week, the former George Stephanopoulos show that will soon be with a new host on Sunday, they will have a fact check every week. In other words, a politician will come on, say his or her thing, and then they'll have this meter whether it's true or not. Now, the question is whether they're going to get guests anymore because nobody wants to be called a liar. But maybe that's the way to do it. You just have to have a lie detector attached to anything that people say anymore.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your work, and thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Dave, for the call. Let's take another one, 614-292-8513, and see if I can see straight. Pat, you have a question about representatives who do work across the aisle or whether they are working across the aisle. You're on the air.
You call for Pat?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, are there any, you know, I get lots of fundraising approaches from various candidates, and actually, you know, if somebody in another state is doing what we hope that Congress people do, I wouldn't be against donating to that person to show my support. Are there any candidates coming up for election that you think could or make an attempt to work with the opposite party?
You mean like old-fashioned, Ken?
Well, there's fewer and fewer of them. I mean, one of the top Republicans who used to do that was Ray LaHood, who's now the Secretary of Transportation under President Obama. Here's the problem. If, let's say, you're a moderate Republican and you want to talk across party lines and be, you know, accommodating, things like that. Well, but But the problem is that they'll be suddenly, once you do that, then the conservatives get enraged and they challenge them with a primary in their state and say, look, if you're going to be one of those Democrats or a rhino, a Republican in name only, we might as well elect a real Republican in the primary. And so every time there's a Republican who tries to go across party lines, like Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, he'll be threatened by retribution at home. Lindsey Graham has now been censured or denounced by about a half a dozen county Republican organizations in South Carolina because he has the temerity to talk to John Kerry about climate change or things like this or about judges. So there are some who would love to talk across party lines, but they always get threatened by primaries back home, and it's true in both parties.
Senator Voinovich crossed the aisle to vote for the unemployment insurance extension.
Yeah, and I have a feeling it's not going to hurt his reelection chances.
It will not. I mean, exactly.
Exactly, right. It's amazing. Once you announce your retirement, how free you can do.
Free.
Free to exactly express the way you feel.
I know this is a broad painting things with a broad brush, but I wonder if more women might in the legislative bodies might soften that approach.
Well, there's a good you see that in the Republican Party. You think of the two Republican women from Maine, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow, mm-hmm. who always talk to Republican Democrats, and of course they get blasted by more conservative people. And you know, you also when every time you read about sex scandals in Congress. Seems like women don't participate in sex scandals. I don't know what's wrong with these women, but no.
Boring.
But there seems to be something about, look, obviously with women being 51, 52% of the country and yet only a fraction in Congress, that's something that has to be changed, and it has been slowly changing, but very slowly.
Well, you know, but actually there's been sort of a backtrack in Ohio. There's fewer women in the legislature, or at least in the Senate, than there were 20 years ago when I first started covering it. Isn't maybe this rancor a turnoff to a lot of women if you follow that logic?
It is, and just like my friend who wanted to run for Congress, I said, why would you bother doing it? It's very possible that women who say, look, I want to make a difference, but I don't know if anybody can make a difference. Why do I want to put myself and my family through this upheaval?
Okay, Pat, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We're almost out of time. I'm not going to be able to take the rest of those calls. We got into a lot of kind of heavy, deep philosophical stuff today, Ken. Is that happening a lot?
Well, you know, every time I keep thinking, and everybody says, boy, there's nothing going on. There's so much going on. I think people really do care. And there's, but there's so much emotion. There's so much. We talked about the misinformation out there. But a lot of people really care, and they really want this stuff to work. And I even think the people who are involved in the process, even if they may be ideologically pure, they probably, you know, who knows, they go home and say, gee, I wish it wasn't this rigid and so unchanging, but it seems to be unchanging.
Well, hopefully something will change so we can talk again next time.
Well, whether it does change or not, I'd love to talk.
All righty. Well, Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Better known as, well, see, NPR's political editor, better known as political junkie. Thank you for being on the show again.
And thanks a lot.
Take care. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.